trivia today. Thank you for coming, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to study with you. I hope we have enough books. I started off making 25, and I talked to Albert, and he said, no, we'll have more than that, so I made 50, and then we made another 25 on top of that. So we've got 75 books, and it looks like we've got about 70 people here. We can make more. If you look at the books, you'll see that all four of today's lessons are the first four lessons in the book. And I went ahead and put tomorrow's lessons that I'll be presenting in the worship assemblies. I went ahead and put those in. And then I did an addendum. There's just a lot of stuff about leadership that I think is critical that we don't have time to present this weekend. So I did add six more lessons on the tail end of that. Some really what I think is significant stuff about cultural change. You realize that our culture is undergoing radical change, and it has been for the past 8 or 10 years. And of course, culture is always changing, but our culture is changing in ways that I think forces us to look at our means and methods, how we're preaching the gospel. One of the things that we need to say is that the message of the gospel never changes, but the methods that we use for communicating the gospel and for reaching people, sometimes that changes. And so I have done some work on cultural change in a couple of those lessons. And the last two lessons in the addendum have to do with surviving and thriving in the 21st century. We don't want to just survive. We want to thrive. We want to do well. And hopefully the lessons that we present today and tomorrow and the other lessons that you may read in the book, hopefully they will benefit you and will be a blessing to you and help you. One of the reasons I mentioned striving and surviving is, I'm sorry, surviving and thriving, is that a lot of churches are in crisis today. You look at mainline denominations, many of them that have 500, 800-seat auditoriums, like I know there's a couple of churches in Beaumont, a Presbyterian and Episcopalian church, Methodist church, huge auditoriums, and the auditoriums are not one-third full on Sunday morning. Some of those churches are just collapsing from within, and sometimes it's the doctrinal positions that they have taken. There are other churches, though, that are just stagnant, not going anywhere. It's not doctrinal problems. They just are stagnant, and they're not doing anything, not reaching the community. Why do these things happen? Well, some say that it's the corruption within the religious bodies themselves. Others say the times in which we live. Indeed, we live in, I think, perilous times when it comes to religion. You realize that across the board, in almost every kind of denomination, Protestant, Catholic, fundamentalist, whatever it may be, church attendance in America is declining. There's no question about that. Barna has shown that, and other pollsters have shown the same thing. What's going to happen to us? What happens to God's people, our local congregations? God still has a body of people who are committed to Him. I don't think we should be pessimistic. I think you and I, as men of God, as leaders, whether we're preachers, deacons, elders, or whether we're just young people who have obeyed the gospel, we should not be pessimistic. I believe that we may be on the verge of growth and strength that has been unprecedented in our generation. I don't think that we're doomed to repeat the errors of the denominations. We believe in God's plan. You realize that we're involved in the greatest work that the world has ever known. You remember Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44, when Daniel was interpreting the king's dream, and he talked about the great image, and he talked about in the days of those fourth kings. He said, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. It will not be left to other people. He went on to say in the end of that verse that it shall stand. For how long? Forever, that's right. And we sing a song. Forever and ever. It shall stand forever and ever. Amen. And so we're involved in that kingdom, the kingdom that was in Daniel, in Daniel's prophecy. We are part of that kingdom. And so we are involved in a kingdom of greatness and a kingdom of success. The only thing that is going to last when this old world is on fire is the kingdom of God. And so we will be taken up to heaven to be with our God forever and ever. But if we're going to have success, we've got to have men and even women women who will step up to the plate and will do the work that God has given. Now, when I say women, I'm not talking about women preachers, women elders, or something like that. You understand from 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, that women have different roles to play in the kingdom of God than men do. But it's men who are elders, men who are deacons, men who are preachers. God, though, has always raised up leaders to lead his people. You look in the Old Testament, you see, and I always mention two or three women in, when I do this, women like Esther, what a great leader she was. Deborah, a great leader. But you had great leaders like Nehemiah. We'll talk a little bit more about him tomorrow. Men like Joshua, that we'll see more about him today. God has always had people who would step up to the plate and who would provide the leadership that was necessary. And what they had in Old Testament Israel, we need something similar to that today. Now, we're not looking for national leaders like in Old Testament Israel, but for leaders in local congregations who will be to their generation what people like Timothy, Priscilla, Aquila, Phoebe, Epaphroditus, and so many others. And the names that I've just mentioned, these weren't all elders, they weren't all evangelists, but these were leaders who served the purposes of God in their time and in their generation. They were servants, servant leaders, servants to God and his people. This morning, what I want to do is talk about a ladder, what I call the ladder of leadership, rungs on the ladder of leadership. And our knowledge of that ladder is really fundamental with respect to having the kind of leadership God wants in his church. Now, I'm going to do our studies today somewhat in a class-type format. We're all gathered here, and I've got a class podium. I'm not in the pulpit. And I'll walk around a little bit, and I will ask you some questions from time to time. And don't hesitate to answer. You know, at home, our congregation is an unusual congregation in some respects. We've got attendance of around 350, 360, and we've got probably 35, 40% of our congregation is black. And we've also have Asians and Hispanics. And you give our people a chance to speak, and they all want to speak at once. And so North Alabama, a little more conservative, okay? A little more sedated, if that's the right term to use. But if I ask you a question, give me some help on that, whether you're young or old, whether you are an elder or not, preacher or not, whatever you may be. Well, let's talk about this ladder of leadership. There are going to be four rungs on the ladder of leadership, and you'll notice that my outlines are pretty complete. Some of them have got a lot more information than others do. It just depends on which lesson you're looking at. And I know people always want to look ahead. Well, what's on the next page? And they'll look ahead. You can do that if you want. And when we have a break, we'll have a break after this lesson. We'll take probably 6 or 8 minutes between the two lessons this morning, and we'll do the same thing this afternoon. The first thing that I want to talk about is learning about the need for leaders. I think in past generations, we've not paid enough attention to this. And without effective leaders, everything breaks down. When you look at school systems, our school system in Beaumont, Texas, where I preach, got so bad 5 years ago that the state actually took over the school system and kicked all the administrators out of the school board, fired all of them because there was so much corruption. Leadership was destroying our school system, the wrong kind of leaders. When you look at nations rise and fall based on leadership. Same thing is true with football teams. Anybody have a football? Any Auburn fans here? Auburn? Ooh. Not many. Okay, some over here. This brother here is going to break his arm getting it so high. Thank you, brother. What about Alabama fans? Alabama? Yeah, a few of those too. Thank you, guys. Okay. You know what happens. You got a great coach. Saban is a great coach at Alabama, doing a lot of good wins game after game after game. Auburn's good too, and I'm not going to speak for or against either one. But you know what happens when you don't have the right kind of leadership. You've got to have leadership on the sideline, and you've got to have leadership on the field. And when you do not have effective leadership, you're going to have trouble. Okay? I'm going to ask you a question. Old Testament Israel, Northern Kingdom, went into captivity. Somebody tell me why. What was the one issue that people always point to when they talk about why the Northern Kingdom went into captivity? idolatry. What happened to the southern kingdom? It was idolatry. Don't be afraid to speak up. There's no test this morning. But it was idolatry, wasn't it? But why? Why did they go into idolatry? It was a leadership problem. I want you to slip with me over to the book of Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapter 34, and I'm specifying verses 5 and 6 because they are the critical part of this text. However, I want us to see, maybe start at verse number 1. It won't hurt us to do that. We'll start at verse 1 and just read a few verses here. Now it says in Ezekiel 34 and verse 1, the word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Notice he speaks of the shepherds. He's not talking about the men out in the field who are tending their sheep and their goats. Who's he talking about when he says shepherds of Israel? Who's he speaking of? He's speaking of the leaders, prophets, priests, princes, kings, these men who had the duty to lead the people of Israel. He said, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, Thus says the Lord God to the shepherds, Woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flock? You eat the fat and clothe yourselves with the wool. You slaughter the fatlings, but you do not feed the flock. The weak you have not strengthened, nor have you healed those who were sick, nor bound up the broken, nor brought back what was driven away, nor sought what was lost, but with force and cruelty you have ruled them. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the beasts of the field when they were scattered. My sheep wandered through all the mountains on every high hill. Yes, my flock was scattered over the whole face of the earth, and no one was seeking or searching for them. And it goes on to say more about the lack of leadership in Israel. You know, it was leaders who introduced idolatry into Israel. Yeah, you saw that in the time of Solomon. You saw it in the time of Jeroboam, leaders who introduced idolatry into Old Testament Israel. And the people of God came to these crisis times, these crisis moments, because of a lack of proper leadership. There, I think, is no greater need in the church today than the right kind of leaders. And it's not difficult to see that. Where I preach in Jefferson County, Texas, and Orange County, side by side, we had, when I moved there 40 years ago, moved there in summer of 1978, I'm not certain of the total number of congregations, but we've lost six or eight, as many as eight congregations have closed their doors in those 40 years. And there should be more Christians today in Southeast Texas than there were 40 years ago if we're doing a good job. But the truth is there are fewer. There's one town, Orange, Texas. Orange used to have three congregations, one that had about 125 people, another that had about 60 people, and another that had about 80 or 90 people. You put those numbers together, you got well over 250 Christians. Today in Orange County, you put what's left, one church has closed its door, the others have shriveled down to almost nothing. You can't find 60 Christians meeting now. What's happened? It's leadership. And almost every time when you see a church that is doing poorly and going down, you know, we blame the times, we blame the economy, we blame our neighborhoods in which we live, we do all these things, but the fact is, bottom line, it's nearly always a lack of leadership. Leaders need to have visions. By vision, I'm talking about looking off in the future and saying, here's where we need to go. And then goals. Here's how we're going to get where we want to go. We've got a mission, we've got a vision, and we've got to have strategy in order to accomplish the work that God has given to us. That's what leaders do. And when leaders have no vision for the future, when they don't think about what we're going to be doing in 5 years from now or 2 years from now, well, things don't go well. Some churches, some leadership, some elderships don't plan beyond next Sunday and next year's gospel meeting. That's about how far we look into the future. We can do better than that. Leaders influence people in God's way. Leaders are able to see what needs to be done, and then they get after it, they do it. But too many churches don't have visions or goals for the future. I want to remind us what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 9. This chapter is one where It's one of the two chapters, chapters 8 and 9, where Matthew lists a whole bunch of visions, or I'm sorry, a whole bunch of miracles that the Lord had performed. And as you get to the end of this section in verses, I guess starting about verse 35 of chapter 9, Jesus went out about all the cities and villages and teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Now, verse 36, but when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them. Why? Because they were what? He said they were weary and they were scattered. They were like sheep having no shepherd. People need leadership. He said to his disciples, the harvest is truly plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. And Jesus said, when you've got people like these who are scattered, having no shepherd, we need people to go out, people who will go out and will, who will teach them. The harvest is plentiful, the laborers are few. Leaders are needed, not for the sake of leaders, but for the sake of God's cause. And so, before I move to my next point, let me just ask you the question. Can you see in local churches, in your experience, that churches that have strong, positive leadership that's moving in the right direction, can you see that those churches are the churches that are doing well? And when there is no leadership, the church has dwindled. Can you see that? I hope you can. Because that's what, if you get around in different places across the country, you'll see that over and over again. Here's our second rung on the ladder of leadership, and that is learning what leadership is. I think there are a lot of misconceptions about leadership. One of the misconceptions is that leadership is about intellect. You know, let's take the smartest guy and make him the leader of the group. That doesn't always work. A man may be a genius when it comes to math and science. That doesn't mean he has leadership skills. I joined the Air Force 5 days out of high school when I was age 17. And somehow, they made me the leader of the group there at the induction center. And I was supposed to get the guys from the induction center to the bus station out to Weir Cook Airport in Indianapolis. And then we're going to fly up to Chicago. We're going to change planes. Then we're going to fly to San Antonio. I'm the guy who's responsible for about 18 or 20 others. Now, I'm 5'7". I weighed 125 pounds at the time, just fresh out of high school. I don't know how I got made the leader, except for the scores on my aptitude test. I still think they got my test mixed up with someone else's, okay? But at age 17, I wasn't ready to lead them. And someone says, well, but you were the smartest guy in the group. I don't believe I was the smartest guy in the group, but I was certainly no leader of men at age 17. You know, if you want to get 18 guys together and one guy to lead them, you take the biggest, meanest, and ugliest guy and put him in charge, okay? That's because the people will have some respect maybe for him. But intellect doesn't necessarily make someone a good leader. Several years ago, there was a controversy over marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and someone wrote a little article and sent it around to a lot of people and said, what we should do is the liberals and the conservatives should take the two smartest men, the smartest men on the liberal side and the smartest man on the conservative side, and get them together and let them decide what's right, and we'll believe what they say. Well, that's a wacky way of deciding what's right. But just because people are smart doesn't mean they're going to figure things out when it comes to any issue. So intellect doesn't necessarily make you a good leader. What about achievement? Achievement is one of those things. Well, here's a man who has won accolades. Here's a man who's a champion. Let's make him the leader. Well, you shouldn't confuse achievement with leadership. I like the example of Richard Petty. Probably every lesson we'll do this weekend, there'll be something about cars. I am a car guy. I love cars. I love auto racing. I love old cars. I love big block Chevys, small block Chevys. I even have an affinity for old Ford flatheads. But I like the example of Richard Petty. He's one of the great drivers of all time. Seven-time cup champion. And yet in 1996, Richard Petty ran for Secretary of State for the state of North Carolina. And the people rejected him as a leader. They did not elect him. And though he was loved by everyone, They still did not elect him. And since his retirement from driving in 1992, his team has never really had any good or great achievements, never had a really good winning season. He's a great driver. But being a great driver on the racetrack doesn't necessarily make you a great leader off the racetrack. Achievement doesn't always get the job done. And then there's management skills. Someone says, well, this guy's a pretty good manager, you know. I watch him oversee a project, and in this project, he orders supplies, he makes a plan, he follows blueprints, he's got a schedule for how everything ought to come together in this project. Well, that's all good, but he may not have the skills that make people want to follow him. Just because you're a good manager in a project doesn't make you a good leader. And then here's the really big one. This is the one that is the biggest misconception among our brethren, and that is position. Like one man said, make me an elder and I'll be a leader. No, you become a leader first, then we'll make you an elder. You've got it backward. The most common myth about leadership is that if a person is given a position, that automatically makes that person a leader. Now, there's a fella in the Old Testament. You may remember his name. In fact, I know you know his name. Fella in the Old Testament. Handsome fella, tall. You know, he had the qualities that we say, you know, if a fella's good looking, tall, strong, good voice, why, he's a natural born leader. We say things like that. And this fella in the Old Testament, he was made a leader and he had all those qualities. You remember his name? King Saul. Everybody knows about Saul. I sat down one time in doing a lesson on leadership and listed every mistake that Saul made. I found, I think, 18 or 20 mistakes that he made that leaders cannot afford to make. And what happened? Ultimately, even though Saul was given a position of leadership, he couldn't even get his own army to follow him. Remember the foolish thing he did when he was in battle and he said, hey, nobody gets to eat today until I am avenged of my enemies. You remember that? And his son Jonathan, who didn't hear that command, the word, it was never communicated to him, he found some honey and dipped his staff in the honey and tasted it. And of course, it gave him renewed strength and he was ready for the battle. But when Dad found out, he said, well, Jonathan has to die because he's disobeyed my word. And the whole army rose up against Saul and said, you're not going to kill Jonathan. You see, here's a man who made foolish decisions as a leader, couldn't get his own people to follow him. He completely misdirected the nation of Israel. He made a mess. Well, I'll tell you what he had. He had a position, didn't he? And sometimes you'll see men that just want to be elders. Oh, please make me an elder because I want to get my hands on the wheel here. I know how to drive this church. I know how it should go. And that's sad when people think that. What is leadership? Well, it's not intellect achievement, not managerial skills, not position, but it is influence. Leadership is influence. If you can understand that Jesus is the greatest leader of all time, then you can understand that leadership is influence. How many people has Jesus influenced to follow him? Millions upon millions. No other leader has ever been his equal. In John chapter 1 and verse 43, what was he doing? He was calling a few fishermen to follow him there in the early part of his ministry. John chapter 1 verse 43. The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, follow me. And now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter, and Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we found him of whom Moses and the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. And so whether Jesus is calling a few fishermen by the Sea of Galilee or whether he's teaching this massive multitude of people in the Sermon on the Mount, no other person can match Jesus when it comes to influence. Consider that it's almost 2,000 years now since his birth, 2,000 years removed from the ministry on earth, and still men are following him. He continues to have the greatest influence on history of any man of all time. Leadership is influence. Are there other factors beyond influence? Well, there are a lot of factors that go into making influence, and there may be other factors too, but leadership is influence. Someone said, if no one is following you, you're not a leader. If no one is following you, you may just be taking a walk. So we need men of influence, and that's the essence of influence, is getting others to follow you, regardless of your intellect, regardless of your achievement or position. And one of the reasons that I mention women when I discuss these things, and we'll talk much more about this tomorrow, one of the reasons I mention women is that you look in your congregation at women of influence. What are those women doing, women of influence? You see, they're not elders, they're not deacons, they're not preachers, not song leaders. What are those women doing? They're women that are looked up to for leadership. We're not talking about appointing women to some office in the church, but you see women in your congregation who are leaders in your congregation. What kind of qualities do you see in those women? Somebody help me. What is it? Yeah, okay, they're well studied. And you can go to them and you can ask them, I'm having trouble understanding this text in Acts. Can you help me? And here, a young lady who wants to be a good student, she sees this older woman who's well-studied, and so she goes to her. This older woman is a woman of influence. What else do you see in women of influence in your congregation? What is it? Approachable, yeah. And that's always a quality of leadership. And when you allow people to come to you and approach you and seek guidance and so on, instead of standing off and being kind of a hermit, you see women who take the lead when it comes to maybe someone's sick in the hospital, somebody's got to take care of their kids, someone's got to provide food for the family, or maybe the mom is just sick and home in bed with the flu for 2 or 3 days. And there's almost every congregation has one or two women who are going to get on the phone and they're going to say, Sister Johnson is ill. Can you prepare a meal for the family tomorrow night? That's leadership, isn't it? You see women who lead like that. And so leadership is influence. Women, men, whatever they may be, the definition of leadership was first given by J.O. Sanders in his book, Spiritual Leadership. He made the simple statement that leadership is influence. There may be more other things you can add to that, but leadership is influence, being able to influence others, get them to follow. Okay, here comes rung number three, and that's learning from the Lord about leadership. You know, years ago, when I talked about the idea of leadership, I said you can go to Barnes & Noble or you can go to B. Dalton at the mall. There used to be a store called B. Dalton, people. B. Dalton, I think, has closed their doors, and Barnes & Noble has just barely got their head above water. Where do people go if they want a book on leadership? You go to Amazon.com, you know that. Everybody does that. That's where we buy our books today. And if you just type in leadership, there will be well over 1,000 books that will come by. I don't even know how big the number is, but it's well over 1,000 books on leadership on Amazon.com. And some of those books can really be helpful to God's people. I think they can be a blessing. But the one book that is most neglected is the most important book in the world, and that's the Bible. The Bible is a book on leadership. It's a book about leaders. Give me some examples. Let's see if we can name 10 different kinds of leaders from the Bible. Not looking for names at the moment. Let's see if we can name 10 different kinds. I'm just going to start over here. Somebody give me one word. What is it? Okay, spiritual leaders, okay. These may not have an office per se, but there's such a thing as spiritual leadership, isn't there? Okay, give me something more specific, maybe an office or a role that someone plays. Someone over here first. Okay, you got kings. A king is a leader, isn't he? Give me some more. Priest. Someone's thinking prophet. They're afraid to say it for some reason. I don't know. What is it? Father? Yeah, how about father? That's a role. Bible has a lot to say about that. Give me some more over here. What is it? Apostle, yeah. Apostle is a leader, isn't he? Husband, yeah. We had father, now we got husband. You can go on and on with that. The Bible is a book about leaders, about prophets, priests, princes, kings. It's about apostles, deacons, shepherds. Shepherds, those are all leadership roles. The Bible gives us examples of good leaders. Give me three good leaders from the Bible, excluding Jesus. Jesus, we know, is the ultimate. Give me, someone over here, give me one great leader from the Bible. David. Okay, David's a great leader. David was great at getting his army and leading them into battle. Who? I heard another. Paul, great. Moses, great leader. Joshua is a great leader. There are so many others that we could think about. On the other hand, you got some bad leaders, don't you, in the Bible? And while you can emulate the good leaders, you want to avoid the mistakes of the bad leaders. And of course, Saul always rises to the top when you talk about bad leaders. There are others, though, the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah. Was there ever a... How many good kings can you list in the northern kingdom? There's really not any. You might say, well, Jehu did some good things. I like Jehu because he drove his chariot fiercely, okay? That's the car guy reference coming out in me again. If some of you I know have been in Israel, and if you ever get to go to where Jezebel's palace was, you stand there on top of that palace. It's never been really unearthed. The archaeological work's never been done on. But you can stand up there and you can look off to the north and you can see where Jehu would have come down through the valley and driving his chariot fiercely. Well, it's easy to find good and bad leaders in the Bible. The Bible shows us how leaders were to be trained to serve God. And it instructs us about the process of mentoring. In fact, our last lesson today, lesson number 4, is going to be about mentoring. The Bible is a leadership book. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. Do we really believe what this verse says? I think we do. And yet I think we fail to apply it when it comes to leadership, because the Bible doesn't have a title on the cover that says Principles of Leadership. But the Bible is about leadership. It doesn't have a book in here that's entitled Leadership for God's Men. But it's still about leadership, isn't it? In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, the scripture says that all scripture is given by inspiration of God. It is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. Does the Bible really provide us with everything that we need to effectively serve God? I think it does, and I think you believe it does. If so... If the Bible is what it claims to be, then it is a leadership book. But here comes the fourth rung. Yeah, we see something about the need for leaders, and we see something about what leadership is, and we can learn from the Lord about leadership, but our fourth rung is learning that leadership requires growth, and to me, this is the most significant of the four rungs of leadership. And I like to ask people... I often do this when I'm teaching a men's class. Are leaders made or born? And there's a common belief among an awful lot of people that some people are just born leaders. And I realize that some people have qualities that will help them to be good leaders. You're better off to be as a man. You're better off to be 6'2" than 5'2" if you want to lead others. Though Napoleon was very short and he led people. If you've got a deeper voice, a more commanding voice, that's a benefit to you. If you're handsome, there's a couple stories I can tell about that. I'm not going to at this time. My point is, there are some things that may be valuable to a leader, but they don't make you a leader. It is better to understand that leaders are made. They're not born. Leadership requires growth. We're not born as leaders, but we're born to be leaders. God wants His people to be leaders. Being a leader is more of a process than an event. You know, you can take someone like King Saul and say, here, an event gave him the position as a leader. But the event didn't make him what he ought to be. It requires growth to become an effective leader. King Saul failed to grow. In fact, he went the wrong direction, and he never became the effective leader of the nation. Josiah, how old was Josiah when he became king? One of the young guys. Josiah was how old, son? 8 years old when he became king. Let me ask you, what is your name? Stuart. S-T-U or S-T-E? S-T-U-A-R-T, Stuart. How old are you, son? You're 20. Handsome young man. Got qualities of leadership already. How tall are you, Stuart? 6 foot. He's working on it. He may grow another inch. 20 years old. You know, you also look like you're about 16. And you know what? You don't like that when you're 20 to look 16. But when you get 40 and people say you look 30, you're going to like that, okay? Yeah. So Josiah was 8 years old. Stuart, how well equipped do you think Josiah was at 8 years old to be the leader of God's people? Probably not. Probably right, son. Josiah is not prepared to be a leader, but he became a great leader, didn't he? And there was a great revival led by him, not at 8 years old. And when you read the text back in 2 Chronicles 34 and also in 2 Kings chapters 22 and 23, what you will see in the story of Josiah is a story of growth. When he's 16, here's a marker in his life. When he's 20 or 24, another marker in his life. And he began to seek the Lord, and he had someone guiding him and someone training him, mentoring him. And a study of his life is a study about growth. You see, leadership requires growth. His life went through all these stages, and he eventually led the nation of Israel to a great national revival. Josiah turned out to be one of the great leaders of the Old Testament. The Apostle Peter. Did the Apostle Peter need to grow as a leader? When Jesus found him, what would you say about Peter? Tell me a little bit about him. Tell me a little bit that you know about Peter when early in the Gospels. He's impulsive. What else? He shoots his mouth off sometimes. He does dumb things. He argues with Jesus, tells Jesus he's wrong. Not a good quality of a leader. This man is impatient, but he became a great leader. And yet, even after he was a leader, long after the church had begun, he still made some mistakes, didn't he? And Galatians chapter 2 chronicles some of his problems. Look at young Timothy. Timothy starts off as a boy, but he achieves much as a man. His life is a picture of learning. He was mentored by the Apostle Paul until he himself had grown to the point of mentoring others. In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, one of the most critical passages on leadership, 2 Timothy 2:2, the Apostle Paul said, "Timothy, the things that you've heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." And so Paul is reminding Timothy, "Timothy, when you were traveling with me, remember all those things I taught you, and I taught Titus, and I taught Epaphroditus. Okay, I always had two or three of you traveling with me everywhere, and you were learning, you were being mentored. Now, Timothy, now you have to take up that role of the one who does the mentoring. Get yourself two or three young men, and you take them with you wherever you go. You train them to do the work that I trained you to do." And so, Timothy, again, his life is a picture of growth. But my classic example I want to use this morning is that of Joseph. Demonstrates that leadership requires growth. You know that Joseph's an unlikely leader. He has to overcome all sorts of problems in order to become the second ruler in all of Egypt. How old was Joseph when he was sold by his brothers into Egypt? How old was he? 17. How old was he when he ascended to the second position in Egypt? 30 years old. Good, guys. And so we've got 13 years of what? 13 years of growth, but we're more likely to say 13 years of trouble, because this man had one problem after another. fact, there were problems even while he was at home because his brothers didn't like him. Joseph became, and I emphasize that word became a great leader. He wasn't born as a leader. In fact, there were things in his life that were going against him, that were limitations that had to be lifted, had to be removed in order for him to become what he became. Let me ask you, he had been his father's pet, favorite, good. He had been his father's favorite. Now, when you've got all these older brothers and here the younger brother is dad's favorite, does that produce leaders? What does it usually produce? If you've got the young brother and here's 10 older brothers and dad favors this one, first of all, he's going to be hated as Joseph was. But how's this going to turn out for Joseph? You know, sometimes when your dad's favorite and you're treated in a special way, it just produces a brat, not a leader. And then when his brothers treat him unfairly, they throw him into the pit, they sell him to the traders, he goes down into Egypt, he might have been consumed with what? Self-pity, feeling sorry for himself. Poor me, you know, everybody hates me, nobody loves me. My little sister used to sing a song, "Everybody hates me, nobody loves me, guess I'll go eat worms." I don't know if you ever heard of that or not. But that's self-pity. And the way Joseph was treated, you could see how that he could turn to self-pity. And then when he's in Potiphar's house, he's doing well and he's progressing and things are going well and Potiphar has a lot of trust in him. But then Potiphar's wife frames him for a crime he never committed. And he gets thrown into prison. And how would a man in prison, how would he look at life? How would he face life? A man in prison, what might he turn to? Maybe more self-pity. What else? Bitterness, bitter resentment. Hates the world because the world has treated him so badly. And then in prison, he gets to be like a trustee. And here's the baker and the butler and someone's supposed to remember him, but they don't remember him. He's left there for 2 years in prison. All these things Joseph has going against him. But in spite of all these obstacles, Joseph rose to a position of leadership in Egypt. He had developed and demonstrated competence while he was in Pharaoh's house. And that prepared him, or rather Potiphar's house, that prepared him for the job that he would have as Pharaoh gave him that great office a little later on. And what was Joseph in all these trials and troubles when he was hated by his brothers, sold into slavery, framed by Potiphar's wife, cast into prison, forgotten by the man who was supposed to help him in prison? Where was Joseph? What's he thinking all the way along? Give me some help on that, guys. He sees the hand of God. And Joseph is unswerving in his faithfulness toward God, not turning to the right or to the left. What was it that he said to Potiphar's wife? Yeah, you ever preach and you get the wrong name and you keep saying the wrong name? I remember one time I was preaching in Baytown, Texas, and I was preaching on Joseph, and I would read the text about Joseph, but I kept saying the word Daniel for some reason. A lot of similarities between Daniel and Joseph. I kept saying Daniel. And Daniel fled from the presence of Potiphar's wife. And you know, once you realize you've done that, it's embarrassing. But you know, at the end of the lesson, I said, "I've been saying Daniel. I'm sorry, guys." And one old black sister, Sister Cooper, sat through that preaching and she said, "Brother Dawson, I know that Potiphar's wife was no account, but I never knew how much she got around till I heard you preach." What was it that Joseph said to Potiphar's wife when she tried to seduce him? What was it? Somebody over here, help me. What is it, brother? How can I commit this great sin against God? You know, the interesting thing is Joseph thinks more of Mrs. Potiphar's marriage vows than she does. He knows he's not going to be involved with her, but this is a great evil. It's a great evil against my master, and it's a great evil against God. This is a man who has unswerving faithfulness to God, and he always believed that God's way was best. And listen, there's a lot of young men today that would be maybe 30 years old like Joseph is, or younger than 30 he would have been at this time, who would like that situation. Yeah, here's a woman trying to seduce me. Everything's cool. The master's gone away. I can get away with this. But here's a man no one knows except Mrs. Potiphar, Potiphar's wife. And he says, not going to get involved in this. This young man knew that God's way was best. He consistently demonstrated patience, integrity in dealing with others. Now, was there a single event in Joseph's life that made him a great leader? We know he was a great leader. He turned out to be one of the great leaders of the Old Testament. But was there a single event in his life that made him a great leader? Well, you might point to the fact that Pharaoh chose him to be over all the granary and the 7 years of prosperity and the 7 years of famine. That's all important. But there wasn't a single event in his life that qualified him as a leader. Rather, it was a long, slow process. From age 17 to 30, some 13 years, this long, slow process, all the problems that he went through, these things, because he was faithful to God, through all the challenges and problems that he faced, these things equipped him to be the leader that he became. What if Joseph had never gone through all these trials and tribulations and his faith had never been tested? What about if he'd gone through all these disappointments, had never gone through these disappointments and all these failures? What if one day out of the clear blue, Pharaoh says, hey, we're having a national lottery. Who's going to be number two in the land? Okay, we pulled Joseph's ticket. You see, I don't think Joseph would have been prepared. Joseph was prepared to be a leader because of the struggles that he experienced, and it was God working behind the scenes to make him a leader. You know, you may go through struggles and disappointment in your life. You go through hardships, people being unfair to you, saying things that are not true about you. But you be unswerving in your faithfulness to God, and you continue to do the right thing, because it just may be that God is working behind the scene to make you a leader. The very things that are challenging you and presenting problems for you may be the things that are preparing you to become the leader that God wants you to be. Leadership requires growth. Joseph's story is one of growth. It shows what can happen with respect to leadership when the right things are consistently practiced. Joseph became one of the great leaders of all time and was used by God. Faithfulness, consistency, what Joseph did every day made him the leader that he was. Calvin Murphy played for the Houston Rockets from 1970 to 1983. And one of my favorite sports stories is about him. Back in about 1980, a couple years after we moved to Texas, a sportscaster for KTRH in Houston was interviewing Murphy on the radio. And I happened to be listening that evening when he was being interviewed. And it was an interesting and surprising interview, to say the least. Calvin Murphy stood only 5'9", same height as I am, but his quickness and defensive skills made him a star in the NBA. He was the Rockets' all-time leading scorer until Hakeem Olajuwon broke his record. And Calvin Murphy still holds the record for the most consecutive free throws. But this reporter on KTRH said, Calvin, what's it like to have the natural talent that you have? And Murphy came unglued at that point. He said, I have no natural talent. The skills that I have been acquired from the time that I was a little boy playing in that back alley behind my granny's house. And I learned to dribble the ball in that back alley. And as I grew older, I would stand at one point and I would stand here until I made 10 shots in a row from this point. Then I would move to another point and make 10 shots in a row. This kid, from the time he's 10, 11 years old, is training himself to become a great basketball player. And every day he practices. And even as a Houston Rocket, even when he's the MVP, he's still out there sometimes in the gymnasium picking a spot and making 10 in a row from that spot. There was never any single event that made Calvin Murphy the player that he was. It was the years of practice, the years of hard work. Murphy had invested thousands of hours in training to make him the player that he was. His skills were the result of growth. And if he had never spent countless hours working in an empty gym with no one watching, he would have never played in an arena that was packed with 20,000 people. The story of Calvin Murphy shows what can happen on the basketball court when discipline and hard work are consistently practiced. Growth is the result, but growth doesn't happen overnight. For Murphy, growth came from what he did every day. There was never a great single event that made him a star basketball player, but it was on the court that he showed that he was a star. And he became a star by what he did every day of his life. And that's the way it was with Joseph. And that's the way it's going to be in your life. There was never a great single event that made Joseph a leader. It was on the throne as second in all of Egypt that he showed that he was a leader. But he became a leader because of his daily routine. What he did every day, a routine of faithfulness to God, consistency in service, and persevering in the face of all of his trials. How many of us would stand up to what Joseph stood up to? Would stand tall and be consistent and faithful to God in the midst of all the trials that he had? I hope all of us would. But I want to tell you, if you're going to be a leader, it's going to happen the same way with you, that you need to be consistent in your service to God, faithful to God, persevering in all of your trials. I've taken you through four steps on what I've chosen to call rungs on the ladder of leadership. The first three are relatively easy and can be learned rather quickly. The fourth step is where the time, the toil, and the tenacity are needed. You can learn about the fourth rung quickly, that leadership requires growth. But the growth necessary for leadership is not quick. Like Joseph, we need to persevere. Let's take some questions. What questions do you have for me? Questions, comments. I'll take either one. Questions, comments.
One thing I noticed about Joseph was kind of provocative to his brothers. So if you think about it, he didn't have some variety. He wanted to wear that coat. You know, there were some funny lessons he needed to learn. But shortly after him, it's all about the brothers. He was consistently in a position of leadership. Potiphar's house, the prison, and finally,
the brothers pointing out that Joseph did some things before he was sold into slavery. He did some things that were really provocative, that provoked his brothers and didn't help with the situation very much. That indeed is true. You know, sometimes as leaders, we look at something we've said or something we've done and we say, shouldn't have said that. And, you know, it'd be nice if words were like fly fishing. You cast it out there, if it's bad, you just reel it right back in. You can't reel your words back in. Remember in Matthew chapter 12, I believe it is, Jesus said, you're going to be justified by your words, you're going to be condemned by your words. You'll be judged by every idle word that you've spoken. And sometimes, as leaders, we say and do things we shouldn't do. None of us are perfect. We say and do things we shouldn't do, and those things hinder our influence, they hinder our leadership qualities. That's a good comment, though, brother. Another. Yes, sir.
Do you think that becoming a leader, we talked about intentionally doing the right thing, committed to doing the right thing day by day, and practicing what is right in faith and all of that, and development over a long period of time. Do you think that through that process, that it's good or bad or indifferent to intend to be a leader at the end of it, or just keep on doing those things and you will be a leader?
Well, I think sometimes, Steve, the question is, when you're doing the right thing day after day, are you doing it because someday you intend to be a leader? Or Maybe it just turns out that you wind up as a leader. Either way, you know, there's nothing wrong with intending to be a leader. I see young men like Stuart at age 20. 25 years from now, maybe Stuart is an elder in the church. Maybe he's a deacon. There's so many leadership positions, or leadership roles, I should say, that we might attain. But they require the consistency day by day. And, you know, one of the things that I worry about is that sometimes a man early in life might make some mistakes that really hinders him along the way. Rushing into an ill-thought-out marriage, man may have some real potential to be a leader, and he may have potential to be a preacher or an elder, but he rushes into a marriage and he marries someone who 6 years after he's married says, "I don't really want to be married to you." You see, we sometimes make mistakes that's really difficult to undo or to fix. And not only that, but what about committing some sin at an early age and that has terrible consequences? Sin can have awful consequences, you know that. And sometimes those things will haunt you for the rest of your life. Sometimes we may do something that so impacts our influence that people would have no confidence in us maybe for decades. But I like the word you used about intention, Steve. Intentionality. We need to intentionally choose to serve God every day, intentionally choose to pray every day, intentionally study God's word every day, intentionally strive to live right before other people. And with that kind of intentionality, you know, maybe God has a leadership position for us, maybe he doesn't, but we're doing the right thing. That's the most important thing. I really don't like the idea of someone say, "Hey, someday I'm going to be in charge around here." You are? I'm not necessarily liking that attitude. Do you like that attitude? I've seen this more than once. I heard one man say, "When I get to be an elder, here's how this church is going to function." Well, now, first of all, you may never get to be an elder, but you've got your mind made up that you're going to be the driver of the church. You just might be the Diotrephes that we're worried about that might show up at the church as a leader. We need to do the right thing whether we ever get to be leaders or not. There's nothing wrong, though, with a young man like Stuart or a young man in his 30s saying, "You know, if I study, work, be a servant to God's people, maybe I can be a deacon, maybe I can be an elder someday." There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I think we should aspire to serve God in the very best way we can. But how, if you want to serve God as an elder, what do you need to do today? You need to serve God today and be a servant today. Instead of thinking of the eldership, and we're going to say much more about this in our next session, instead of thinking of the eldership as, well, you know, I get the power now, I'm in control, I get to make the decisions, I can make decisions better than most people. You know, that may be the wrong position to take. But we're better off to say, how can I serve God's people today? And when you serve God's people today, you will gain the influence that you need as a leader. And it will prepare you for what is to come. Intentionality, though, is important. I think that you choose every day to be what God wants you to be. Another question or comment, observation. Yes, Wayne? Yeah, mission, vision, and strategy. I put the three words in that order. Mission, I think we've already been given a mission. Our mission is to proclaim the gospel in our generation, to reach as many people as we can. We want to help people go to heaven. We want to keep the saved and bring the lost into the fold of safety. We have a mission statement in our congregation. I'm not sure that I can word it properly before you, but we want to be a local assembly of saints, a family that wants to reach out to the community and teach the gospel to bring them into the fold and then to build up the saved. That's what we see as our mission. That's very broad. I realize that. But secondly, there's the idea of vision. Vision is, where do we hope to be in 5 years or 10? And what we've tried to do, and I will be frank with you, we've not done very well on this, but what we've tried to do is think out 10 years. 10 years from now, what do we think we can accomplish in 10 years from now that we're not doing today? And then we say, if we work hard and we reach out to the community and we're aggressive in evangelism, maybe we can move the congregation from 300 people to 400 people, maybe. And look, someone says, well, we shouldn't be thinking about numbers. We want to just convert as many as we can. Well, obviously, we want to convert as many as we can. But if we don't put some kind of a mark out there, something to measure it by, how are we going to know if we're making progress? And so if we say over the next 10 years, we'd like to see the congregation here grow in number from 300 to 400. But not only that, we would like to see the people within the congregation to grow personally. And so we set a vision, and 10 years out, okay, where would we hope to be at the halfway point? Here's 5 years out, and then here's 2 years, and then here's 1 year. And then along the way, what we've got to do is to have a strategy to implement this vision in order, the strategy, that's where you get down to, here's how we're going to do it. I didn't bring anything on mission, vision, and strategy, but if you'd like, I can print out something and give it to you. We've done some work on that. My order is mission, vision, strategy. I say my order because some people reverse those two. They start off with vision, and they say, here's what we want to be, and now we're going to define our mission by our vision. I see it the other way around. I don't know which one is supposed to come first, but I know this, that if we don't do some planning for the future, our future is not going to be very good. People who don't plan are people who don't do. And the reason for having a mission statement and trying to cast a vision, and you all understand when we say vision, we're not talking about a miraculous vision. We're just trying to look ahead and say, here's where we want to be. It's like when you're traveling. You know, Lee and I left Beaumont, Texas on Thursday morning, and we drove to South Alabama, stayed with a family there. We knew that yesterday afternoon we wanted to be here in Athens. Well, you know, that's a kind of a short-term vision, but we've got markers along the way. We know we're going to reach Baton Rouge, and we're going to fight the traffic there, and we're going to get to Mobile, and it's going to be good, and we're going to come through Montgomery. Then we're going to be slowed down an hour in a traffic jam in Birmingham. You know, we look at the obstacles, and we say, we can overcome this, and finally we reach Athens. It's like a journey, like a trip. That's what a vision is. Here's where we want to be at such and such time, and here are our markers, our guideposts along the way that's going to get us there. That's what we try to do. That's the idea of vision. And if you don't have some kind of plan, one of the points that I will make, I think, in the Sunday afternoon lesson tomorrow is about Alice in Wonderland. You remember the Cheshire Cat? And Alice came across that cat, and she said something like, would you please tell me which way to go from here? And he said, well, that depends a great deal on where you want to be. And she said, it doesn't much matter. And the cat said, then it doesn't matter which way you go. That really is the truth. If it really doesn't much matter where you are 10 years from now, 5 years from now, then it really doesn't much matter what you do today. See, it's the long-term goals and strategy along the way that drives us daily. We get up in the morning and say, okay, I've got a mission. I'm working on something today, and here's my strategy. Here's the part that I have to implement today, because a year from now, I hope to be here. And I hope to be here a year from now, because 2 years from now, we've got this marker, 5 years, and so on. You've got a plan, and if you don't have a plan, you're not going to get anywhere. Our lesson tomorrow afternoon, and it's in the back of your book. Actually, it's lesson 6 in your book. He began to build. And to talk about the builder in Luke chapter 14. The builder in Luke 14, he's going to build a tower. And Jesus said, now, this fellow needs to do what first before he starts that tower? Count the cost. And because if he starts to build the tower without counting the cost, he's going to run out of money or run out of something, and what happens? Then everybody looks at him and they begin to mock him, saying, "This man began to build and was unable to finish." Well, we're all builders. We're building on our own lives, and we're building in respect to the kingdom in our local congregations. And so we need to have a plan, need to count the cost, and all the things that go along with that. I hope that helps a little bit, Wayne. I did not bring a lesson, though, on mission, vision, and strategy with me. Any other questions, comments? Anyone on this side? All the way in the back. Yes, sir.
I think as people, we recognize that we need leadership. And so we're going to have some leadership of some sort. It may be Saul because he was put in charge. It may be Peter because he was the loudest in the group. We are going to have some leadership. It could be, you know, the elders because they have the title as elder. It could be a group of people because they're the loudest in the group. You know, it could be anything. And I think that emphasizes a lot the need for sound leadership, for that growth to happen.
Yeah. The brother is saying that in every circumstance, you're going to have leadership, whether it's a poor leader like Saul or a great leader like Joseph. You know, if you put five kids together at random, pick five kids at random, they're all between 8 and 10 years old, and put them in a room, in 5 minutes, a leader will emerge. There'll be a kid who'll say, "Hey, let's do this. Let's play this game." And maybe another kid says, "No, I think we should do this," and he may overrule. And that maybe this other kid becomes the leader. But it only takes a very few minutes for a leader to emerge. And if five of us, here the old man and four others, were lost out in the woods, someone's going to emerge as a leader. If not, we're just maybe going to be scattered in the woods. But it's almost always the case that a leader emerges, and emerges rather quickly in any group, which just emphasizes the need for leaders who are properly equipped. And that gets to our fourth lesson today. I'll take one more question, then we're going to do our break. Another question, anyone on this side? Comment? All right. It's about 12 minutes after. Let's restart at 10:20, okay? At 10:20, we will restart. Thank you.